evening, America. Welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show. No, this is not Leslie Marshall. This is Mark Levine, your most frequent favorite fill-in host for Leslie Marshall. I know Leslie's your favorite, but I really hope to be your number two. Please make me your number two tonight. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 866-6-LESLIE, 866-653-7543. I've got two things on my mind, and they are completely different. One makes me nervous, and one makes me angry. What makes me nervous is an international question. What makes me angry is a local issue. First, what makes me nervous. You, like I'm sure, did see the President of the United States speak to all of us from West Point, New York, last night, talking about his plan to send 34,000 troops into Afghanistan and to begin withdrawal of those same troops by July 2011. Now, as I'm sure you realize, the president has been thinking about this for about 3 months, for quite a long time to come, and I've got a lot to say about it. Mostly, though, I guess I agree with the president because it's a very close decision in my mind and I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. I like the fact that there is a set withdrawal date. It may be impossible what we seek to achieve in Afghanistan, but I think we should give it, the old college try, even though I recognize that it is at a risk of American lives. We will certainly lose some American lives. There will certainly be Afghani lives lost. I think it's worth the effort, and I'll tell you why in just a bit. But first, I want to tell you why I'm angry. Many of you who listen to Leslie Marshall's show live in New York State. Well, I'm mad at you. Well, I'm mad at your state. More specifically, I'm mad at your state senate. Actually, your state assembly is very good. Now, I'm not a New Yorker, and it's only with trepidation that I venture into New York state politics. For all I know, that could get me in quite a lot of danger with the wrong people. But I'm going to do so nonetheless and say that you need to elect some new New York state senators. You need to get rid of your Republicans, every single last one of them, and you need to get rid of 8 renegade Democrats, who I will say by name, Stokowski, Montserrat, Carl Kruger, Honorato, Huntley, Diaz, Obertine, and Adebo. And I'm appealing to all of you who live in New York State to have primaries and to kick them out of the Democratic Party. They don't belong. They voted against civil rights today. So those are my two issues. Again, they're very different, but I figure you have an opinion on one or the other or both. And I encourage you to call in 866-653-7543. Let me start with Afghanistan, and then we'll get to New York, and then we'll kind of mix and match and try to find some way in which the two topics are connected. I don't know of any, but maybe one of you will think of some way to connect the two. As you know about President Obama's speech, he'd been planning it for 3 months. Specifically, he'd been planning the decision. Now, for those of you on the left who are complaining about us going to Afghanistan, let me say that I share your concerns. I share your worries. I know that Afghanistan is an incredibly primitive country. I know that Great Britain tried and failed to occupy it, that the Soviet Union tried and failed to occupy it. I'm with you. I recognize that 80% of the population is illiterate, that it is a very mountainous, difficult terrain, and that that it's difficult to conquer. So I recognize all of that, let me just say right at the outset. But I also recognize, as did the great majority of Americans, that on September 11th, 2001, we were attacked from Afghanistan. We were attacked by Al-Qaeda, who was housed by the Taliban, and they murdered 3,000 Americans. And I worked in Congress. I was in Congress the very day in a House office building that we were attacked. I know that all of those of you in New York will never forget it, and obviously your pain was the most severe. But if you live outside of New York, those of us in the Washington, D.C. area were perhaps secondly most affected by it. I happened to drive home and see the Pentagon in flames as I drove home, and I am fully aware that the final plane, the one that good patriots took down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, was probably intended for the United States Capitol, and it would have killed a number of my friends, who knows. I wasn't intending to be in the Capitol that day, but the office that I was in is connected to the Capitol underground. It would have been ugly. It would have been horrific. I have to tell you that after September 11th happened, I wanted to declare war. Many of you know I'm a constitutionalist. I fully respect the letter of the Constitution. Some call me a liberal strict constructionist, and I happily retain that label. I believe the words matter. I believe the law matters. And I wanted a declaration of war, a formal declaration of war. I was so angry that day. We were attacked. It was unprovoked. 3,000 innocent Americans died. I don't know anyone that can't read the stories of the people who died September 11th and feel tremendous pain. And yes, I wanted war, and I wanted us to fight and uproot the people that did this, whether it be Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or whomever. So I, like the great majority of you, supported our war in Afghanistan. And as you probably know, the vote in the House had only one dissenter, Barbara Lee of Oakland, California. Every other member of Congress that voted in the House or the Senate voted to support that war. Now, the Iraq War, of course, it was different. The Iraq War was one that, there was a lot of disagreement on. And I did not support that war. We were not attacked. Iraq did not attack us. Saddam Hussein did not cause September 11th. That was a very different thing. But the Afghani war was always the good war, the just war, the war that made sense, the war of self-defense. And for the last, 7 years or so, from 2001 to 2008, we puttered along in Afghanistan. Here you had a country that is 50% larger than Iraq. You may not know it. You know, on the map, they just show you the two countries. You might think they're the same size. No, Afghanistan's 50% larger. Far more difficult to conquer. It's got a lot of mountains. You know, it's one thing to spread out across a hot desert. It's hot, true, but you don't have to climb some of the highest mountains on the planet. And it's got lots of valleys and caves for people to hide. It's enormously more complex. It's 50% larger in area. It's larger in population. And yet George Bush put 10 times the troops in Iraq than he did in Afghanistan. It's almost like Afghanistan, he went to war because everyone was mad and he understood that the American public would not countenance going to war only in Iraq when Afghanistan attacked us. Everyone would be like, huh? What? Why are we there? Does it have something to do with oil? So it's almost like he had to go to war in Afghanistan in order to justify his later war in Iraq. But we never really fought very hard there. To be clear, the men and women, our brave men and women that are over there, I know, are doing the best they can. But let's face it, they weren't given the support they need, not just in terms of body armor, but just in terms of sheer numbers. And President Obama, when he was merely Senator Obama, argued in the campaign, you may remember, or you may have forgotten, that we needed to beef up troops in Afghanistan even as we drew them down from Iraq. So those of you on the left that are upset by what the president did last night need to at least concede that this is what he said he would do all along in the campaign. And let me give you more. At the very least, he reconsidered it, even though he promised to do it. And even though the Republicans accused him of dithering, he spent 3 months. And I'm sure that our president, a very intelligent man, analyzed each and every possibility. Everything from the small number of troops to more troops to getting out entirely and fighting them with drones and aircraft to having more of a presence in Pakistan. And at some point, and I know this is hard because, for you Republicans, it doesn't exist at all. But for we Democrats, I guess I have to trust the president. But that doesn't mean I always trust the president. I certainly didn't trust George Bush, who seemed to make a decision off the seat of his pants. Remember, George Bush decided to invade Iraq not after September 11th, but at least was considering it back 10 days after he was president, January 30th, 2001, in the great book, The Price of Loyalty by Ron Suskind. We've seen the maps of Iraq, where they divvy it up into 12 separate oil fields. So George Bush clearly wasn't making a carefully calibrated decision. Whatever you think of President Obama's decision, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, I hope you agree with me that it was carefully calibrated. As you know, as you probably know, the General McChrystal asked for up to 80,000 troops, 40 to 80,000 troops. He got 34,000. And he wanted a longer timeline. Obama insisted it be done right away. So he didn't exactly do what his generals wanted. But for those on the left, and I got to say, for people like me who had concerns about fighting this war in Afghanistan, he gave us something too. He said that we're going to start to withdraw in July 2011. And that's good not just as an exit strategy for Afghanistan, but frankly as a way to keep Hamid Karzai on his toes. Hamid Karzai, of course, is the president of Afghanistan, and he is woefully corrupt. Now, is he more corrupt than other leaders of other third world nations? No, but that's a pretty low standard. Virtually every leader of every third world nation, certainly the dictatorships and to some extent the democracies, are pretty corrupt. They're on the take. And unfortunately, it's very, very hard to change that kind of attitude in that part of the world. So I recognize this is a very, very difficult decision. And frankly, I was somewhat sympathetic, I admit, to Vice President Biden's idea. The idea that we don't have to occupy every town or hamlet in Afghanistan. The idea that Al-Qaeda is the enemy, not the Taliban. If you listen closely to President Obama's speech, you heard those elements in his speech. Al-Qaeda is the enemy, not the Taliban. And we should be clear on who's who here. Al-Qaeda, of course, is the group run by Osama bin Laden, is that group of radical Islamic extremists that by no means represent the majority of Muslims, but represent a small but powerful minority of Muslims who believe in, let's face it, Islamic control of the world. Right? They want to occupy pretty much every area of the world, and certainly every area of the Middle East. Indeed, Osama bin Laden's main complaint for why he did the attacks on September 11th was the troop presence, the United States troops in Saudi Arabia. You may recall Saudi Arabia asked us for some troops there after Iraq invaded Kuwait. So it all gets very complicated, but the heart of it is that Al-Qaeda is a belief as much as it is a group of individuals. It is a belief by a certain small but very virulent minority of Muslims, mostly Arabs, that they should violently attack us, the United States, and virtually all of the West. Now, they were housed by the Taliban. The Taliban, while also a radical Muslim group, was mostly concerned with ruling Afghanistan. They are not Arabs. They are Pashtuns. That's the name of the people, the majority people of Afghanistan, but only about 60%. There's a good, solid minority of Uzbeks and others that were in the Northern Alliance, Tajiks and others. But this majority group of Pashtuns ruled Afghanistan because after, well, there was a king for a number of years, and then the Soviet Union came in and made a mess of things, and then there was a civil war. The Taliban brought some kind of order. They stopped a lot of the civil war. Now, it was a pretty ruthless order. And they certainly mistreated women in the process. But let's not confuse the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And when I come back from the break, I want to explain why the Al-Qaeda is definitely something we need to destroy, while the Taliban, strangely enough, I believe is someone we can work with. Toll-free number 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine with the honor and privilege of filling in for Leslie and giving you, in the 4 minutes we have in this segment, the entire history of Afghanistan. Ready? Okay, so for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, Afghanistan was in a relatively primitive state. Many would argue it hasn't changed. But basically, Afghanistan follows a very clear rule of clans. It works something like this. If you might have a fight with your brother, but you stand with your brother against your cousin, and you stand with your cousin against someone else in the clan or in the tribe, but you and your tribe stands together against a fellow tribe, and all of your tribes bond together against an outsider from a different province, and all the provinces bind together only once when there is an outsider from outside the country. Think it's difficult to help Afghanistan? Just think of that general tribal principle. But that's the way Afghanistan was, ruled by warlords, a lot of local control, as you would expect in a very mountainous country. In fact, Switzerland was formed the same way, another mountainous country, with a lot of federalism. Federalism is a weird word. It sounds like a federal government's in control. Really, of course, what it means is a lot of local control and a weak central government. Well, that's the way that Afghanistan has been for centuries. Indeed, it's the way Switzerland and even the United States began, although we have a lot of federal control now. In any case, Afghanistan was that way for a large number of years. The British came in as part of their great war against Russia, failed to fully occupy it, did install some kings, and in fact there was an Afghan king that ruled relatively unmolested for some 40 years. That gives us some hope. Afghanistan can be ruled relatively peacefully. King Zahir Shah ruled from the 30s to the 70s. Then came the Soviets and messed everything up. Of course, they wanted a client state in Afghanistan. And as I'm sure you well know, we helped to arm the Mujahideen, the members of these various tribes, to fight against the Soviet Union, which finally had to withdraw in the early 90s, plunging the country into civil war. The Americans withdrew. Many Afghanis complain about the fact that we withdrew. And the warlords fought amongst themselves for so long that the people were ready for some kind of order, any kind of order, and thus came the Taliban. In the mid-90s, the Taliban began to grow until by the late 90s, and by September 11, 2001, they had most, but not all, of the country. And they had a fairly radical Islamic agenda. As I'm sure you know, it was very harsh toward women. They were required, whether they liked it or not, to wear the burqa, which means to cover themselves head to toe with only slits for their eyes. And they didn't let girls go to school. It wasn't just against women, though. The Taliban were quite ruthless in maintaining power, but they did bring order, they did bring stability, and ironically, they lessened violence. Because there's less violence under a strong dictatorship than there is in a civil war. And so many people welcomed the Taliban, not so much because they enjoyed their ideals, but at least after many years of civil war, they kept order. Then came September 11th. Then came the American people rising almost as one, at least 99% of us, to support taking out Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which housed them. And of course we did, in relatively short order, mostly using, by the way, Afghani troops, mostly from the Northern Alliance, the non-Pashtun tribes, those Tajiks and Uzbeks that I've talked about. And they helped us to get rid of the Taliban leadership. In fact, we even trapped Osama bin Laden, it's clear now, in Tora Bora, while George Bush refused to give 800 more troops begged for by the CIA to do him in. We trusted the Afghanis to do the job, and, well, they didn't do it. They could be paid off by the highest bidder. Suggests that we might have some problems in the future. Coming up after the break, we'll get to the future, the dilemma, and Afghanistan in the O's, and your calls, 888-6-LESLIE, right after this.
Leslie Marshall, the simple truth in a complicated world. 888-6-LESLIE.
Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. As I said, I've strived to be your number two radio host. I'm giving you the history of Afghanistan. Now, you may have wondered why I spent the last 5 minutes before the break giving you thousands of years of Afghani history. Well, this is why. We've talked about the fact that in the 90s, because of the massive civil wars left by feuding warlords left over from the end of the Soviet invasion and the Mujahideen that we supported, including, by the way, Osama bin Laden. Thanks, Ronald Reagan. He couldn't have known. Because of this feuding, the people of Afghanistan largely turned to the Taliban, at least the Pashtun elements did, that majority in the south, because they wanted order. And the stability of a dictator actually is better for many than the violence of a civil war. So they turned to the Taliban. Then you know what happened. Taliban took in Al-Qaeda. We were attacked on September 11th. America went to war. And quite easily we removed the Taliban government, at least in the capital of Kabul. And George Bush inexplicably messed up and let Osama bin Laden go. I'm not saying he did so purposefully, but I am saying he did so negligently. In any case, what happened then? What happened then is George Bush decided to focus on Iraq. And Afghanistan was, what we used to call the red-headed stepchild. Sorry, redheads. It was the bastard. It was the secondary war. It was the unimportant war. Let's focus on Iraq, a country that never attacked us, instead of Afghanistan, from which we were attacked. Now, maybe that's because Iraq was easier than Afghanistan. I don't know. Maybe it's because there's more oil in Iraq, much more, than Afghanistan. I don't know. For whatever reason, George Bush took his eye off the ball. and in a smaller country with a smaller population that's easier to occupy with more deserts than mountains, he put in 10 times the troops. So Afghanistan languished. We did not have enough troops there to control the country, to give order to the country. There's never been a strong central government, at least not since King Zahir Shah. And what happens? The warlords start fighting with each other again, just as they did 10 years earlier. And what happens? People again turn to the Taliban. Now, they don't turn to the Taliban because they like Taliban ideals, at least not most of them, but because they gave them some security in an insecure world. It's very much like, do you remember your history classes on feudalism? On European feudalism? It wasn't that the vassals wanted to have lords there running their lives, but they'd rather have a lord with a big castle and a little bit of an army protecting them from the rival lord than to be all off on their own. So in the O's, just as in the 90s, they turned back to the Taliban. And today you will see most of southern Afghanistan, unfortunately, controlled by the Taliban. Now, I said in the last half hour that the Taliban isn't really our enemy, that Al-Qaeda is. Al-Qaeda, I think, is irrevocably determined to try to destroy the United States and kill all of us and bring an Islamic world nation. There's no negotiating with them. But the Taliban is, well, let's face it, it's a large group of people, a motley group of individuals. Now, I'm not saying negotiate with Mullah Omar, the former head of Afghanistan, the head of the Taliban, or the senior leadership. But for the vast majority of people who join the Taliban at a local level, they're just looking for security. That's why I do make a distinction between Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Just as I would make a distinction in World War II between the Nazi leadership and ordinary Germans who fought in the war. They had to be defeated, but that doesn't mean that the ordinary Germans, at least most of them, were committed to Nazi ideals. Or if they were, they could be taught not to, as we've learned in the post-war era. So we have to distinguish between the two. And what President Obama is striving to do, and I realize it's difficult, is to give some order to the Afghan population so that they don't have to turn to the Taliban. And that may require more local control, as I said. That's definitely going to require some push on Karzai not to be as corrupt as he is. And it's going to require some help, both more troops from us and more troops from our coalition. So I'm nervous, but I'm willing to support Obama's limited strategy. What do you think? 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Dan from West Seneca, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Mark. You know what? I enjoy you. You're very informative.
Thank you.
But I couldn't help but think as I was listening to you, I mean, why are we there? That's what I get from it. Your description in history of Afghanistan, all I can think to myself is George Bush was crazy for getting us involved over there, and Obama's not much better.
Well, look, I'm going to agree with you at the outset that there's a lot of risks and we may not succeed. That's why I like, you know, it's interesting. A lot of the Republicans criticized Obama's plan, which is, you know, a bunch of troops now and a beginning withdrawal by 2011. They said, I heard Lindsey Graham say this, he should go all in. And I'm a poker player, so I know what all in means. All in means you stick all your chips in the center and then you either win a dramatic victory or you lose everything and you're out of the game. All right. That's an all in bet. I think Obama has done what we call in poker a tester bet. And again, I'm a poker player. Maybe poker players will appreciate this more than others. But what you do is you put a little bit of your stack in the pot, maybe a significant amount of your stack in the pot, and you see.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Well, let me finish my analogy, and then you can ask me all the questions you want. My point is, on a tester bet, you see what happens. If somebody raises you all in, if they put all their chips in other words, if you're going to lose, you get out with as little damage as possible. You don't risk everything. And I'm nervous enough that I think this sort of mid-strategy is the best hope. We try to win. We see what we can do. We see if it's possible. And if it's not possible, we get out. Now, what's your question?
Okay, using your analogy, because I like your analogy.
Thank you. I'm glad you do.
We've been there for 8 years. That's an awful long tester bet.
But, Dan, we've only been playing the antes For 8 years, all we've done is ante up. You know, again, I gotta, for those of you that don't know poker, ante up is you, every time you play, you got to give some like one chip in the pot just to play. That's all we've been doing. We haven't really tried to win a pot ever. I mean, George Bush has put in, as I said, a tenth of the troops in Iraq in a country that's larger and more difficult to occupy geographically. We haven't really even tried. That, to me, is what the tester bet is all about. Now, you may think it's doomed to fail, and I would agree with you that it may fail. But I also think it has a chance of success.
You can throw an analogy.
Okay.
What is the end game? What is there to win? In poker, when you're all in, you stand to win a whole bunch of money. And if you lose, you walk away from the table broke.
Right. Here's the end game. Here's the end game. And I don't think we're going all in. I think the Republicans want us to go all in. The end game for me is a stable enough Afghanistan. Note that I said enough. I'm not trying to describe Switzerland here, or even Mexico for that matter, but stable enough that the people feel they don't have to turn to the Taliban. The goal is not to have a place where Al-Qaeda operatives have safe haven. Now, I fully admit to you, and I haven't even gone there yet, that the real battle is not in Afghanistan. It's in Pakistan. And anyone who's really studied this question knows that there's at least 30 times the numbers of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan as Afghanistan. But as long as Afghanistan is undecided, is porous, is not stable, is controlled by the Taliban, then we can't even begin, I think, to go into Pakistan. I think, and President Obama hasn't consulted me on this, but I think that what's going to happen as we put a lot of troops in that mountainous region is we're going to sneak into Pakistan. Again, if he said this, he might get in trouble, so he's not going to say it. I will. Remember, he did say it in the campaign, that we'll go into Pakistan,
comment,
the mountainous areas, and we'll fight them there. Go ahead.
You're terrific, but you're making it even more scary. You're not talking about just Afghanistan. You're talking about a stepping stone to Pakistan. You know what? I think we opened up a can of worms and snakes are coming out. I don't think we're ready for this.
Well, I'll tell you this. I certainly don't think we should occupy all or even most of Pakistan, but there is that tribal area, that mountainous area, Baluchistan, the Waziristan, the northwest frontier, that where we think Osama bin Laden is hiding. And I think that under international law, as a right of self-defense, we have the right to take him out. If we can take him out, we should. That we've got to destroy this safe haven from whence they're planning attacks. And if the whole thing fails, well, Dan, we'll be out by 2011. It's very hard to defend a middle position because you're going to have people that say, like you, we shouldn't be there at all. And you're going to have Republicans say we should be all in. I'm striving to actually support the president's position, which is in the middle. But I see where you're coming from, Dan, and I'm not in any way hiding the difficulties that exist. I think they're severe.
Mark, this is scary. This is a nightmare. I wish it would end. I think you're right in a lot of ways, and it leaves no good solution in the financial burden.
Dan, I'll tell you what, we got to take a break, but I want you to hang on with me. You're a good caller, and I also want Daily Dave and Scott to hang on, too. We're going to have a whole bunch of calls. That's fine. When we come back, Dan, I want to know how you would have dealt with September 11th. Because to me, if we do nothing, it means that we're not fighting back in our own defense. So I want to hear your ideas and also those other callers. 888-653-7543. Back after this. Welcome back. The Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine. I am filling in for Leslie Marshall. And Dan from West Seneca disagrees with me, but he does so very thoughtfully, and I very much appreciate his call and even his disagreement. Dan, you've been saying that really you think this is all, I guess, a quagmire. You didn't use those words, but that it is a point of no return, that we shouldn't be there, that we should bring, I assume, all our troops home, right? Is that fair? Is that what you're saying?
That would be fair. That's definitely how I feel.
Okay, so here's my question. We were attacked on September 11th. 3,000 innocent Americans were died. The attack was unprovoked. How do you think we should have responded after that attack?
Okay, I'm gonna do the best I can. I might not be as knowledgeable as you, and I might not be politically correct.
You say what you want to say. Go ahead.
First off, Iraq would have never entered the equation.
I agree. Let's stipulate. We'll stipulate that. I completely agree with you. Tell me about Afghanistan.
Okay. Now, I think the pretext for going into Afghanistan was the hunt for Osama bin Laden. So
not just the hunt, but also the fact that the Taliban had bases for Al-Qaeda. They literally had training bases in there where they trained people on how to attack us and others.
Okay. I agree with you, and you're more knowledgeable, and you completed my thought. I neglected to put that in there.
Okay.
But I would have been mindful that the individuals that flew the planes, I think it was 14 individuals, they were from Saudi Arabia.
Just to be fair, it was 19. Well, no, you're mostly right. It was 19, 17 from Saudi Arabia, 2 from Egypt. So you're basically there. Go ahead.
Okay. So I think that I would have more vigorously pursued responsibility with the Saudi government as to how come they didn't stop those individuals before they ever got airborne.
Okay, but just so you know, I mean, these 19, there were the 17 were of Saudi heritage. I mean, they were born in the Saudi Arabia. They're Arab. The two are Egyptians, but they were trained by Al Qaeda in Afghanistan. So I don't know how you hold. I mean, I got lots of problems with Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Frankly, we could do a whole other show on my problems with Saudi Arabia and Egypt.
We're on the same page. I mean, I'm not as knowledgeable as you, and I won't pretend to be. But I'm trying to answer your question.
Right. You can't blame them for individuals. Is what I guess what I'm trying to say. I mean, we had Timothy McVeigh. You can't say that if Timothy McVeigh killed a guy from England in Oklahoma City, that England can attack the United States. I mean, you can't. I don't think you can blame Saudi Arabia per se for these individuals. I guess is what I'm saying.
And I did not do that. I said that I would pursue them vigorously, whether it was their intelligence. Certainly, they got a finger on what's going on there.
Well, that's
in
true.
The region.
Right? I accept that. Yes.
Okay. So now we're going to get to Afghanistan, and I think that I remember we really bombed the bejeemers out of Afghanistan at Tora Bora, and we thought that we had gotten Osama bin Laden. And at that point, I was almost in agreement. I'm against war. I certainly think diplomacy is the better way to go.
Well, I agree it's the better way to go. I just think that war is sometimes necessary as a last resort.
Well, I'm not Neville Chamberlain.
Okay.
He messed up with Adolf Hitler, right?
Right. There are times for war. We may disagree on when they happen, but neither you nor I are pure pacifists.
Right. No, I agree. But I think that we could have strategically bombed in Afghanistan. We could have had ground forces, and we could have defined how long they were going to be there and what they were there for, and we could have used bunker-busting bombs. We could have used drones.
Okay. No, I get it. Frankly, we did a lot of that air strategy in our war in Kosovo, whether or not you supported that war.
Bill Clinton and
right.
Madeleine Albright
That's right.
were successful.
That's true. I do think it was easier than Afghanistan, but you're absolutely right. Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright were successful, and I believe we lost 3 American lives in that entire war.
And we certainly did not spend the financial resources, and really we have impoverished our nation. This debt that is building at some point, I think, has to be repaid, and the only thing that I could think is the next generation of young Americans are going to be no more than indentured servants to President Bush's folly.
Well, Dan, you make a lot of good points. In fact, in the next hour, I want to talk about a war tax, actually, to pay for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. I think you make a lot of good points. I don't know that your strategy alone would be successful. I think that, frankly, we've done more than your strategy, more than the bombing with at least the limited troops of George Bush. So, but I respect where you're coming from, and I really appreciate your call. Thanks so much.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you. Let me go to Daily Dave, who's calling in from Hawaii. Dave, what's your thoughts on President Obama and his plan?
Hey, Mark. Yeah,
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it very much. Have you seen Black Hawk Down or read the book?
I haven't, but I know the story. But
okay.
I probably should see the movie before I comment on it. Go ahead, though.
Yeah, what's critical to understand is that when the CIA, and, well, there are two things that are critical to understand, that when the CIA trained the Mujahideen to use RPGs to shoot down Russian helicopters, that information then in turn went to the Sudan Mozambique, but that's not right either, where Black Hawk Down
could be
occurred.
Somalia, Mogadishu, is that what
Mogadishu,
you think?
Yes, thank you very much. And then back to Afghanistan, where the Taliban remnants of the Taliban are harassing us now. And so I think there's a critical lesson in there somewhere, but I'm not sure what it is.
It's probably the lesson of blowback, the lesson that just about every military action we take has unintended consequences. For example, arming. I mean, it seemed absolutely right. And you know, Jimmy Carter did it in the 70s, certainly Ronald Reagan did it in the 80s. It made perfect sense to arm the Mujahideen to fight against the evil Soviets invading Afghanistan, right? Well, there was blowback, and one of the people we trained was Osama bin Laden. So I think that's what you're trying to tell me? Is that right?
Well, that's the first thing.
Okay.
But the other thing that needs to be understood by you the point that I want to make that needs to be understood is that, jet fuel on September 11th did not make the Twin Towers fall straight down. And that's the other critical part about this whole war on terror that has never been explained to me satisfactorily.
Well, if you're going to argue that the Bush administration planted explosives in the World Trade Center, then you and I are going to part ways on that.
Well, that's fine. But, you know, in the history of modern industry, only three buildings have been felled by fire, and they were all on the same day. So I think that's worthy of investigation.
Look, everything's worthy of investigation, but when I hear these complaints, and it's not about you, Dave, by the way, I think you're a great caller, and I'm glad you call in every time you do.
Thank you.
But I do disagree with you on this, and I assure you I disagree with people on this long before I heard of you. and the reason is very, I mean, are you a mechanical engineer or a structural engineer?
No.
Okay, I'm not either. But when it comes to things like this, I tend to trust the experts. I have a certain expertise.
Right,
I have
but there are experts that would... That
not
would
many, no. I mean, look, I have a degree in economics, I have a degree in law. When it comes to economics and law, I consider myself an expert, at least enough to challenge other experts. When it comes to medicine, science, I mean, for example, I believe in global warming, but I'm not a climate scientist. But I recognize that the vast majority of climate scientists believe that global warming is happening. I recognize that the Arctic ice cap is melting. And so I'm willing to accept their view, even though I'm not a climate scientist. When it comes to the World Trade Center, I'm not an engineer, but I have talked with several engineers about it. I have read their accounts. I think it is distinctly a minority view. And at the end of I have to say, Dave, I think a lot of the animus and a lot of the belief for the 9/11 conspiracy comes from true anger at the Bush administration, which I share. But I say there's proof that the Bush administration tortured. There's proof they had secret prisons. There's proof they were spying on all of us and breaking the laws. And that's all I need. I don't need something for which I've seen no evidence. There's more than enough to complain about. And I think when you mix things that I are at least uncertain, and I would argue really have not been proven, with things that we know to be true, like they stole the election of 2000, then I think it makes all the real complaints we have look bad. So I'm not going to justify 9/11 conspiracy, but I always appreciate your call. If you want to call in, 888-653-7543. I also want to talk about the decision today in New York State. Right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine. I'm with you this entire hour. I have the honor and privilege of filling in for Leslie. Like I said, I want to be your number two radio host. But you're going to get number one back at the end of the hour. You're going to get Leslie. And feel free to tell her how I did. I'll be listening. Like me or hate me, I hope you will call in and tell me what you think at 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Coming up in the second part of this hour, I want to talk about that New York State decision because it really disturbed me. And I want you to stand with me. I need your help, New Yorkers, in getting rid of every single Republican in your state Senate and eight renegade Democrats, mostly from Queens, you know. When I used to watch All in the Family, I remember Archie Bunker was from Queens. And apparently the Queens is full of bigots because four of the renegade Democrats are from Queens. Now, maybe you're from Queens and maybe you can tell me I'm wrong, but the evidence speaks for itself. There's also a Democrat from Bronx, one from Brooklyn, one from Buffalo, New York. That's right, you people in Buffalo. That's right. Let's see who's from Buffalo. William Stokowski, renegade Democrat from Buffalo. And we've got one, Daryl Obertine, representing Watertown and Oswego, New York. So they're on my list, and I'll be happy to support any Democrat in any primary against these people. I want to talk about the decision later part of the hour. First, though, I want to finish up Afghanistan. Yeah, we can resolve it in 1 hour, right? It's only taken, 8 years? It's America's longest war. It may take a decade more. We can resolve it all in 1 hour. And one question I do want to resolve is the very important one raised by Dan of West Seneca, who was skeptical about the whole process. And I have to admit, while I disagree with him, it's a very close decision for me, and I do share his skepticism. But one of the things he was skeptical about was the way to pay for the war. And I wanted to be on record as supporting a bill that's sponsored by David Obey of Wisconsin to have a war tax. You heard me, a war tax. Yes, I'm a Democrat supporting increasing taxes. Not this year, by the way, and the bill recognizes we're in a dramatic recession right now, the worst since the Great Depression. Now is not a good time to raise taxes. But at least a year from now, or maybe 2 years from now, the idea is we should pay for the wars we do. One of the dramatic faults of Vietnam, in addition to all its other problems, was we didn't pay for it. And because we didn't pay for it, we ran up huge deficits, which ruined the economy well into the 1970s. And Lyndon Johnson didn't pay for it because, let's face it, it was an unpopular war. We did pay for World War II and Korean War and other wars. So I would pay for it. I'd have a war tax. I'd have a little tax there that says, you pay what you're going to pay, and then there's the 1% or 2% or 5%, depending on your income, surtax to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you're going to support a war, you should pay for it. And Republican friends who supported the war in Iraq, ask them if they'd be willing to raise taxes to pay for it. Most of them will say no. And then you can remind them that a large part of the deficit is their fault. Indeed, $1 trillion worth is due to our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So at least I'm being consistent. At least I'm willing to pay for it. Scott from Cape Cod, welcome to the show. What are your thoughts?
Yes, hello, Mr. Levine. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'd like to say the United States needs to get out of Afghanistan, out of Iraq, out of the Middle East altogether. We've had over 5,000 dead American soldiers that have died for nothing in vain. Over 37,000 seriously wounded American boys, no arms, no legs. Look, we were attacked on 9/11 because of the over $10 billion the U.S. gives to Israel annually.
Not according to Osama bin Laden.
Military and economic aid.
According to Osama bin Laden, it was because of our troops in Saudi Arabia.
No, we were attacked because the Muslim world was outraged with the $10 billion the U.S. gives to Israel in military and economic aid. Let's be honest here.
I'm being honest. First of all, it's $2 billion. Disagree with it, but it's $2 billion. And secondly, at least according to the head of Al-Qaeda, it was because we had troops in Saudi Arabia. Now, I'm sure you're against that, too. But just to be clear, that is the reason they gave for that attack. I mean, I'm not a member of Al-Qaeda. I don't know their hidden reasons, but that's the reason they gave publicly.
All I'm saying, Mr. Levine, is that the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the American Jewish Committee, the World Jewish Congress, the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, the Jewish War Veterans of America, Zionists of America, and other powerful Jewish and Zionist groups have all railroaded the United States into war in the Middle East.
Into war in the Middle East?
That's right, because we...
You think that we were attacked because of Israel?
Israel? And we have to support Israel at all costs, even though the Zionists murdered innocent and helpless Palestinians. That's
Oh my God. Look, Scott.
Guys are dying for the Jews in the Middle East.
Dying for the Jews. Wow.
That's right.
Scott, look, you could disagree on American Middle East policy. You could disagree on aid to Israel. That's fine.
Yeah.
But you should know, and I'm sure you do know, that aid to Israel is overwhelmingly voted on by the vast majority of Democrats and Republicans, the vast majority of whom are not Jewish. Now, if you disagree on our policy in Israel, all you have to do is make a strong argument on why you don't think we should support this embattled democracy in the Middle East, and then we can talk about it. But to blame it all on the Jews, I think, is a little excessive, I got to say.
We should not support Israel because the Zionists stole the land from the Palestinians in 1948 and simply changed the name of Palestine to Israel. You said a moment ago that our senators and congressmen support Israel. You're right, they absolutely do, because they're petrified that if they don't, Mr. Levine, they will be thrown out of office.
Well, you know what? Every American has the right to throw their representative out of office if they don't like the vote. The NRA, for example, has a very powerful lobby. The ARP, the American Association of Retired Persons, has a very powerful lobby. I don't mind any Americans getting together and lobbying for whatever they want. The reason we support Israel, as I'm sure you realize, is not because there was some Palestinian Arab state that existed in 1948 that Israel took over. I'm sure you know your history. There has never been in any time in all of world history an Arab state named Palestine. There was a British state named Palestine, and maybe you think that the British should still be there today. Maybe you think the Turks, who were there before the British, should still be there today. But the point is I firmly believe that every people should have a state of their own where they can be free and not persecuted. That includes the Jews, whose homeland is Israel. That includes the Arabs, whose homeland is Arabia. That includes the Syrians, the Egyptians, the Iraqis, everybody else. I think one state for everyone, that works for me. But I'll tell you, I appreciate your call. Let me go on to Mike from Westchester, because he may agree or disagree with me on the New York State Senate's decision today. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for hanging my call. I called my state senator today, who happens to be a Republican.
Okay.
And I told him that my wife and I both, she's a registered Republican, so you can imagine we have some pretty good arguments at the dinner table, being I'm a registered Democrat. But we told them, look, we don't agree on a lot of things, but we do agree that it's the 21st century, New York needs to get with it, we need to allow gay marriage in the state. In spite of the fact that both of us also happen to be raised as Catholic, we don't think that we should be imposing our values on other people. I'm just very saddened by this.
Well, good for you, Mike. You're my hero. Yeah. I'm curious, what did your state senator or their representative say to you when you called in?
Basically, I just told them, I told them, look, we think that you're actually a good guy. I don't agree with you on most of the issues. My wife probably does agree with you on most of the issues. But on this one, we stand together.
Did they give a reason?
Okay, well, thank you for your call.
That's what I thought.
Very nice.
Here's what I found very interesting. I don't know if any of you followed the debate today. Mike certainly is on board. But you found all the proponents of marriage equality stand up, talk about their lives, talk about whether it was their lives or their brothers or their cousins or their friends and how they wanted equality and civil rights for all. And then came the chance for people who were opposed to equality, opposed to civil rights, to give their views, and they didn't speak. There was not a single voice speaking against the bill. They'd said nothing. It's fascinating to me because it shows to me that there is zero intellectual reason. There is bigotry. I mean, but not many people are going to stand up and say, hey, I'm a bigot. I want gays to suffer. My religion teaches that they should burn in hell, and I want to encourage them to suffer here on earth. Nobody made that argument out loud. They kept it quiet. And to me, the clear bankruptcy of that position is if you believe it, say it. I got to say, at least Strom Thurmond had the decency to say openly that he was a racist. And just say you're a bigot, admit it, and move on. But to not even defend your vote, to me, I was really struck by that.
They want it both ways. They want the support of people who are against gay marriage, but they don't want any soundbite that can be played against them in the next election.
Exactly.
Saying anything against this, so they can kind of quibble on it, and they can do whatever they kind of want. They can play the field, and it is truly sad in this country that this is the situation. I don't have to say beyond that.
Well, Mike, I'll tell you what. You seem to be clearly a Democrat. Maybe you convince your wife that at least in the next election,
I convince my wife to vote for Barack Obama.
Well, there you go. So, well, convince her to vote for a Democrat that supports marriage equality. Convince her that civil rights are what matters. And let me tell your wife, or if maybe she's listening, and if not, you can tell her for me that I want to actively oppose any Democrat that voted no on this bill, and that includes Stokowski, Montserrat, Carl Kruger, George Honorado, Shirley Huntley, Ruben Diaz, Daryl Obertino, and Joseph Adebo, all of them I oppose. So I'm not doing this as a Democrat. I'm saying oppose every Republican and every one of these renegade Democrats. Politics doesn't matter. Civil rights is what matters. So thank you, Mike. Maybe you can convince your wife to vote that way. I appreciate it. All right, if you want to call in on either Afghanistan or the marriage vote in the New York legislature today, give us a call. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm talking about the decision of the New York State Senate in Albany, as well as the situation in Afghanistan. Either topic you want to talk about is fine by me. The first makes me angry, the second makes me nervous. In terms of what happened in Albany, I mean, obviously we have to be clear, the assembly ruled by a strong majority, I should say. What's with New York politics? Maybe one of you New Yorkers can explain it to me. It ruled by a strong majority, there should be marriage equality. Your governor, for all his faults, and I'm sure he has many, supports marriage equality. What is with the New York State Senate? Now, I've heard some people tell me that maybe it's because they count prisoners upstate, so people downstate don't get all the credit that they should have. But, you know, I used to watch All in the Family. You remember All in the Family?
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Do you remember, I used to watch that opening segment, and then I would see the houses, and I later learned that Archie Bunker, that infamous bigot, lived in Queens. Now, I don't mean to attack all you people in Queens. I'm sure many of you are good people. But I was looking at the 8 renegade Democrats, the ones that voted against the marriage equality bill, and I noted that of the 8, 4 of them are from Queens. Now, that doesn't in any way get the Republicans off the hook. As Mike from Westchester pointed out, they are as much to blame as everyone. In fact, I think the Republicans punked the Democrats. They told State Senator Tom Duane that some of them told him that they were going to vote for this bill, and then not a single one voted for the bill. And it always makes me think, why is it that when Republicans have their bills, they can always peel off some renegade Democrats? You always find Democrats ready, at least some of them, ready to support the Republican agenda. I guess the answer is if you got 2 Democrats, you've got 3 opinions, right? We have a very large tent. But when the Republicans are concerned, they have discipline. And even though apparently there are some moderate Republicans in New York, not a single one of them came forward. But then, of course, there are these 8 Democrats, and 4 of them, Joe Adebo and Shirley Huntley, George Onorato, and Hira Monserrate, are all from Queens. What is it with Queens? Are you full of Archie Bunkers out there? Will anyone come and defend your area of New York City? I shouldn't just say Queens. Obviously, there's Carl Kugel from Brooklyn. There is Ruben Diaz from the Bronx. There is Daryl Obertine from upstate New York in the Oswego Watertown area. And right in Buffalo is William Stokowski. They're renegade Democrats, too. I want you to support any Democratic primary candidate. Well, not any, because they're a bunch of crazy people. But I want you to support a Democratic primary candidate who believes in civil rights, who runs against any of these renegade Democrats. I will support them with my money, and I hope you do, too. I'm not a New Yorker, but I'm going to appeal to you as an American in support of civil rights to knock these people out of the legislature. They're not loyal to Democrats. They're not loyal to civil rights. And let's face it, when you attack one person's civil rights, all of our civil rights are in danger. Now, the other topic I'm talking about, of course, is Afghanistan. Do you support President Obama's decision to send in more troops? Do you think that he should have gone all in and not set a date to end the war? Or do you think that, well, he's gone too far and it's time for us to pull out, that we're not going to be successful there anyway? Toll-free number, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Daniel from Kingston, New York, welcome to the show.
First thing I want to say is about Afghanistan, and I'm an independent, but I voted for Obama. This is a mistake. I don't understand it. If you notice, people on the right are cheering this up more than people on the left.
That's true.
To me, it's a big mistake.
Tell me why.
The English got defeated over 100 years in Afghanistan. The Russians got defeated, and we are going to, too. And why sacrifice young Americans?
You think we can't win. You think we can never really pacify the place and never really get rid of the Taliban?
Time to bring all young Americans home. And second thing, if I can go to a caller before who was ranting and raving about the Jews,
mm-hmm.
I think he said a lot of mistruths, but I also think you did, too.
Okay.
The Israelis, in the form of some Jewish Americans and some non-Jewish Americans, have a very strong lobby in this country. Like early in this year, when Obama first became president, we had all these financial problems, and who did the Democrats and the Republicans push through a non-binding resolution in Congress to support Israel's bombing of the Palestinians in Gaza?
Their response to the missile attacks.
Supporting a non-binding thing. I mean, if you're saying they don't have a big influence in Congress, you're not being truthful.
Here's the thing. There are lots of lobbies. There are lots of lobbies in Congress. There are lots of lobbies in Congress.
I know, but the Israeli lobbies.
I think the two most powerful.
We do give a lot more than $2 billion a year. You're wrong on your facts on that, too. Check it out. Economic and military aid together is way over $5, $7 billion, and all the other things we do for the Israelis.
I don't think it's that high, but I'll tell you this.
They deserve a homeland, sir, but they don't deserve to take over the whole West Bank and everything else. And I noticed you didn't say that the Palestinians deserve a homeland. You mentioned the Saudis, but you never mentioned the Palestinians.
I think there should be a separate Arab state there. And I remember that Clinton offered more than 90%, I think it's like 95%, Israel offered, I should say, at Camp David, more than 95% of the West Bank in Gaza.
And
you may remember Arafat turned it down. I think every people need to stay.
They said it was split up into separate areas, not
it wasn't.
One continuous state.
It was one continuous state.
I don't think the Israelis are all wrong either, but, you know, the Israelis are not all right either. Let's be honest about what's going on. Just because they're Jewish doesn't mean they're right.
Absolutely, and I would ask you to look at Dennis Ross's book. He was there in Camp David.
And look at Jimmy.
You said some things that are wrong. I just want to correct them. It's not true that it wasn't a continuous state. That is a lie that's put forward by some Palestinian groups. But the actual maps presented at Camp David have been shown by the negotiators, by Bill Clinton, and even, interestingly, by the Palestinians have admitted that the final maps were not, they were definitely a continuous state. So I just want to get rid of that. Israel is not all right. Absolutely not. You may not support aid. That's fine. But to be clear, I think every American has the right to lobby for any views, even groups I really detest, like the National Rifle Association. Lobbying to me is part of the American way, and I got no problem with it. Back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. The topics today were supposed to be the situation in Afghanistan, whether or not you support President Obama's decision to send more troops and to begin withdrawal of them in July 2011, and the decision in Albany by the New York State Senate to reject marriage equality. But talk radio being what it is, I've been asked a number of questions on Israel. That isn't where I plan to go, but heck, I don't want misinformation out on the air. So I looked up U.S. aid to Israel. The last caller said it was $5 to $7 billion. I said it was not that high. I said it was $2 billion. Well, the answer is that all the way up, by the way, this is from the Congressional Research Service, just so you know my source, which is a pretty unimpeachable source. I used to work for Congress. It's their job to get it right. According to the Congressional Research Service, the most recent year for which they have aid is 2007, so it's a year old, and it was $2.5 billion in combined military and economic aid. I said $2 billion, it is $2.5 billion, nowhere near $5 to $7 billion, but it's interesting, it's looking back on the whole history. Most of the time it was in the threes, so it's lower than it used to be. And the one time it was highest was actually under Jimmy Carter in 1979. There was $4.9 billion, almost $5 billion in aid. Presumably that was to implement the Camp David Accord. So whether or not you support aid to Israel or not, at least know the facts. One thing, though, I think we should compare, that $2.5 billion in aid to Israel, compare that to the hundreds of billions of dollars, indeed far more than $1 trillion that's been spent on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I think you'll agree that it's a lot cheaper. That doesn't mean that you may not support any aid. You may say, you know, America, go home. You shouldn't have troops all over the world. I do know, for example, that the cost of just our troops in Japan and Germany is in the tens of billions of dollars. And, well, Japan and Germany are pretty rich countries. So at least when you're talking about aid to Israel, put it in comparison with everything else. But if you say, as Ron Paul does, we should give no aid to any other country, if you're against, you know, the Marshall Plan for Europe, at least you're consistent about it, and I recognize that. I do want to go back and talk about our main topics, though. Of course, you're welcome to talk about anything. I'm open. I'll discuss with you. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. But I want to specifically talk about this idea of a war tax and tell you that, in general, I support it. Now, no, I don't believe in raising taxes in the middle of a recession. But I certainly think that when George Bush was in power from 01 to 06, certainly in the years from 2003 to 2006, before the great Bush depression happened to us, we should have had a war tax. We should have had a tax to pay for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There should have been, on your 1040, on your income tax return, there should have been, okay, here's what you owe. Now add 5% or whatever the number is to pay for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the reason for this is because Republicans are complaining constantly. You hear them on the air day after day after day. Healthcare is too expensive. We can't afford government-run healthcare program. It's going to bust the deficit. We have to stop government spending. And then you look at, the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, and both of them, heck, either of them alone, costs more than the health insurance proposals of the Democrats. But the Republicans never talk about paying for those. Time and time again, Republicans say, I'm against government spending. But they love deficit spending when it comes to the wars they like, right? So it's clearly inconsistent. Every time a Republican tells you that they hate big government, ask about the big government that was spending so much money bombing Iraq. Ask about the big government that thought it was worth hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars, to take out Saddam Hussein, a man that for all his horrificness never attacked the United States. And then say to them, if you supported the war in Iraq, and most of them did, are you willing to pay for it? Because I won't have Republicans complain about the deficits when they know how to fix it. All they have to do is pay for their wars. Heck, if it weren't for the $1 trillion we spent on, more than $1 trillion, by the way, spent on Iraq and Afghanistan, we wouldn't have near the budget deficit we have today. So be consistent. Don't claim you're against government spending. Claim you're against health care for poor people. At least be honest. See, that's what bothers me. I don't mind when a Republican says, look, I believe in war. I believe in conquering Iraq and getting that oil. I believe in responding September 11th and fighting in Afghanistan, which, as I have said, I give tentative support for myself. Afghanistan, not Iraq. That's fine. Say that. And then they can say, but I don't believe that people should have health care in America. I believe that a five-year-old with leukemia should die if they're too poor to afford treatment. I think that people who are too poor to afford heart medicine shouldn't get the heart medicine that might cost $100 or $1,000 a year. They should go to our emergency rooms where we can pay hundreds of thousands of a year for a emergency quintuple heart bypass. At least be honest. Say, I don't believe in health care for children. I do believe in war. And Democrats, the same. Say, I don't support the war in Iraq, but I do support health care for children. But don't give me this malarkey. I'm against government spending. Ask a Republican what they don't like. I don't like government spending. That is a load of BS. They don't like health care for children. Okay. They don't like educational loans. Okay. They don't like Democratic programs. They don't want to pay more for teacher salaries. They don't want all those policemen and firefighters on the street that Democrats pay for with our tax money. Okay. That's something we can argue about. But don't claim you're against government spending. If you find a Republican that says they're opposed to government spending, I suggest you ask them two questions. Number one, did you support the war in Iraq? 95% of the time you'll get a yes. And then ask them, number two, did you support taxing Americans to pay for the war in Iraq, or did you think it should be deficit spending? And 90% of the time you'll get, no, I didn't support a tax. I wanted us to go into debt. I just want to cut other social programs like Social Security or regulation to protect the environment. Well, then just tell the truth. It's not about government spending. It's about you want to cut Social Security. You want to cut health care. You want to cut education funds. You want to make sure that we have enough money to pay for your wars. That's okay. That's your Republican principles. But don't give me this malarkey about government spending. If you really are against government spending beyond its means, if you're really against deficit spending, then I say to you, Republicans, if you support a war, you should support paying for it. And I will put my money where my mouth is and say that I do support a tax to pay for the war in Afghanistan because it's either a tax or a big debt. And the big debt comes to our children. And though I do believe in deficit spending in times of recession like now, 2 years from now when the Obama recovery is in full force, yep, I'm going to support a war tax. What do you think? 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. I am a former congressional attorney, used to work for the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee, House Homeland Security Committee. I have my own radio show in Washington, D.C. called The Inside Scoop. You can find out more about me at marklevineradio.com, marklevineradio.com, or you can Facebook me. Just go to Mark Levine, marklevine. I'm in Washington. But probably best just to go to my website. You can find out all kinds of things there, including my appearance recently on Russian TV. Yes, Russian TV, talking about Afghanistan. Don't worry, it's in English. But right now I want to hear from John in Camden, New Jersey, his views on Afghanistan. John, talk to me.
Yeah, this is John. I think it's all right to tax the rich right now for it, because you go back to 1950, the top tax was 90%.
That's right.
You go back to 1960, the top tax was
70%.
75, I believe.
It was 70, 70.
70. And we had good economies at that time. Now we have the lowest tax on the rich we've ever had, and economy is one of the worst ones we ever had.
It's true. By the way, I don't think that taxing the rich makes a better economy, but I do think that you're right that taxing them doesn't harm the economy, because
the reason is because the economy,
because
they don't buy in proportion to their wealth.
Exactly. You know, you get it, John. I've been trying to explain that to my Republican guests for so long. It's really very simple. You give a poor person $10,000, they're going to spend every penny of it. Or a middle-class person, they need it for their house payments, their car payments, their groceries. You give a rich person $100,000, and he'll just put it in his bank account because he's already got several million. And how many more yachts do you need? You're exactly right, John. And economists will – I studied this in economics. I have a degree in economics, and that's one of the things they teach you in economics class. And it's the marginal utility of wealth. Basically, the poorer you are, the greater percentage of your income you spend, which is why tax cuts to the poor and middle class do a lot more to propel the economy than tax cuts to the rich. You're absolutely right.
And I also think that because the rich are so rich and they're buying so – they bought so many houses, it led to the housing bubble. And because I think they're buying 80% of what's in the stock market, and I think that's leading to a bubble in the stock market.
Well, I'll tell you this.
I think their wealth is doing more to hurt us than to help us.
I don't want to blame all the wealthy here. I think that the reason we're in the Bush Depression has to do with a few, and I don't mean even most, I mean a few extremely wealthy people who are basically gambling with all of our money. I'm talking about the people that invested in credit derivative swaps, the ones behind Goldman Sachs and Citibank and AIG and all, you know, Lehman Brothers, all the ones that failed. They basically played with our money because they were playing with their own money, but because they were too big to fail. And because AIG invests in one-third of every business in America has some connection to AIG, whether insurance or something else, they understood that if they were to go bad, the entire economy would fall apart. And so they forced us, almost like we were hostages, we, the American taxpayer, to bail them out. Now, one of the things I really like that President Obama is doing, and he hasn't done it yet, and I criticize him for not having done it yet, but he does have a lot on his plate, is to regulate financial industry so that they can't do it again. No one should ever be too big to fail, and we've got to watch these markets carefully and regulate them carefully so this can never happen again. But I don't want to condemn all rich people. I think it was a certain select group of very awful people, but I don't think it's fair to tar them in all one brush. I do, though, think it's fair to say that people should be able to give back to their country. If you're very wealthy, you can give more money. If you're strong, you can serve in the military. Terrific. If you're a good teacher, you can help in that way. We can all serve on a jury. We can all vote. But I firmly believe that each and every one of us, in the words of John F. Kennedy, should ask not what we can do, what our country can do for us, but what we can do for our country. And I don't see anything wrong with asking the rich to pay a little more. Now, I wouldn't go back to the rates of 70% or 90%, but to me, 35%, 38%, 40%, that's perfectly reasonable. I agree with you, John.
Yeah, and but also I don't agree that the banks are the ones that are totally responsible for this downturn we're in. If you look at the history of it, we've lost 97% of our family farms, three-quarters of our manufacturing, and at one time, their spending kept up our service economy. Now, because we don't have their spending, and we have such amount of debt out there from the $6.1 trillion that people borrowed out of their houses from 2003 to 2007, and also their car loans, their college tuition, their credit cards, all the money they owe is keeping spending down to about a third less than it should be.
John, let me agree partly with you and disagree partly with you. I first of all, as far as the fact that there are much fewer farms that today and even less manufacturing, some of that I think is just sort of the nature of progress or whatever you want to call it. You can call it regress, but whatever it is, you know, there are not many blacksmiths anymore because no one has to make horseshoes because we all use cars rather than ride horses. Today, a few farms can feed all of us and indeed export a lot to the rest of the world. We don't need as many farms as we did back then. So I'm going to disagree with you on that. But
that's
where I agree
true,
with
but
you,
those,
no, but let me tell you where I agree with you because I think I agree more than I disagree, and then you can respond, all right? I agree with you that there is a huge disparity in wealth that we have not seen in decades. In fact, interestingly, Americans were more equal in the 1970s than they are today. That means that there's an incredible disparity. The top 1% has something like 50% of the nation's wealth. It's very, very high. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I know it's higher now.
I have an economic plan in, and actually they told me, Lautenberg's office told me they checked it out, and basically, it would pay for itself.
Okay, John, what's your economic plan? Go ahead.
Okay, you
can you say it in a minute?
Paying 90 million people, 40 million at the bottom of the economy. You pay their rent, food, and utilities, with a small copay. 50 million other apartment dwellers, you pay their rental assistance, and the end. That's $500 a month. So you get $6,000 spent there. The people.
So basically,
it's $13,000
now. Let me just understand your program. Basically, it's a vast redistribution of wealth. You would take money from the rich and give it to the poor.
No.
No.
I would print the money.
Oh,
to
go into debt.
Start it off.
Okay.
And then you get back more of that money from more of that money than you spend doing the thing.
Right, but when you print money, that causes inflation. I mean, let's just be clear here.
Yeah,
when you print money, you make every dollar worth less.
It doesn't cause inflation because I have that copay on the bottom 40 million.
Okay.
And if you get inflation, you then increase the copay and cut down what these people are spending.
John, I'll tell you, it's an interesting idea. I don't want to go into all the details of it because this could take us a while, but you're welcome to post it on my website. Just go to radioinsidescoop.com or marklevineradio.com. As I understand John's proposal, and I understand I didn't give him the probably 10 minutes he needs to really flesh it out, but basically what he's doing is he's helping poor people pay their rent and middle-class people. I have no problem with that in general, but I have to tell you that while I believe in some redistribution of wealth, I certainly think that the rich can pay their fair share. I'm not a socialist, at least not a pure socialist. I believe in a mixture of socialism and capitalism. Certainly, we have to convince people to get up and go to work every day. And if people are getting a payment for doing nothing, they're less likely to go to work. So I guess I want John's copays to be pretty high because I want people to feel that they have value in what they're doing. That being said, John does make a very good point. We are in greater debt, greater personal debt than we've ever been before in America. He's absolutely right. Car loans, house loans, credit card debt. The reason we're in such debt, let's face it, is that in the 1970s, one wage earner, usually the man, not always, usually the man, would go and work and could feed his entire family. Today, we mostly have two working people, man and wife, for the gay families, man and man, wife and wife. But whatever it is, they are still, with two families, two wage earners, not earning as much as one wage earner did 40 years ago. That's a problem. That's a country going in the wrong direction. So while I'm not a huge fan of sort of massive redistribution of wealth programs, we have to recognize we have a tremendous problem in this country when middle-class people can't get by without having massive debt. And I think one of the ways to fix it, and President Obama's working on this, is to say that these CEOs, the ones who are making hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes for failing companies through golden parachutes, there needs to be a pay cap, at least at the very highest level. The shareholders should have a right to say, we own this company. CEO, I'm sorry, you're not going to get $200 million for running this company into the ground. You know, in Japan, the highest paid people earn, I forget, it's like 40 or 50 times what the lowest paid do. In America, it's hundreds or thousands of times. While I certainly think everyone should work, I don't think people should get something for nothing unless they're disabled or otherwise can't work. Still, we got to pay people at the bottom and in the middle a lot better, because you know what? When you have more equal distribution of wealth, it means that everyone contributes to the economy. I mean, this is where I completely agree with John. You can't buy toys for Christmas, then you can't pay the retail workers who would sell you those toys, and they can't buy toys for their kids for Christmas. We used to have more equality of incomes in America. And while I would never have confiscatory taxes at the 90 or 70% levels, the idea that every American who works hard and plays by the rules should be able to make enough to feed their families, to me, that's the American dream. There's nothing socialist about it. It's capitalism, in fact, that every American who works hard and has a good idea should be able to succeed. I'm going to go a little bit into the third hour, and then we're going to bring Leslie back. If you want to call in, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of truth. The Leslie Marshall Show, 888-6-LESLIE.